Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello, this is Tim Reedy for the America Magazine podcast. We're excited this week to have Father John O'Malley joining us, Jesuit historian. Welcome, Father O'Malley.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Father O'Malley is here in town in New York for a variety of reasons, but he agreed to spend some time with us. Now, first, we're going to talk about a new book that you have, Father, out that you've just submitted to Harvard University Press about Vatican II. Maybe you can tell us about the genesis of that book.
Well, I was in Rome during the Council. I was writing my dissertation, actually, for Harvard University in history, 16th century history, and the Council was going on just about a mile away. So I became very interested in it because I began to see parallels between what was going on in the 16th century and what was going on at the Vatican Council. So I began to, 1971, as a matter of fact, I published my first article on it. And then I began to teach courses on it. Matter of fact, one course I taught was called Two Great Councils, Trent and Vatican II.
Okay.
So that was a lot of fun, and they do illuminate each other. And then I've been lecturing on it and writing on it. Finally, I decided that despite all this written on Vatican II, I mean, the library shelves are overflowing, what's really missing in English, and many other languages as well, is what I call a basic book. That is a book that if someone came up to you and said, I've heard about this thing called Vatican II, what would be a book that would kind of get me into it and sort of lay out the ground rules and so forth? Now, that's the kind of book I'm trying to write. So
yes, there are a lot of books out there that are, you know, sets or volumes, and for the average reader, it may be a little daunting. So you're looking for something that's a little more approachable.
Right. The just finished publishing was a five-volume, multi-authored book that was originated in Italy, but it's in Italian, Spanish, German, French, and English now. And it's wonderful, wonderful for the specialist, but oh boy.
For the rest of us, it
yeah,
might be nice.
And even for the specialist, I mean, with multi-authored books, you go back and forth and they repeat each other, and so you don't know. It's easy to get lost.
Sure, sure. So this book, now where do you start? Do you start, you know, 10 years before the Council, or do you go back even further than that?
Oh, no, I take the long, long view. It's a short, I mean, relatively short book. I'm hoping that it'll be under 300 pages or around 300 pages. But I feel that you'll never understand the Council unless you understand what led up to it. And I do some stuff about the very early history of the Church and councils. What is a council? But then I have a chapter called The Long 19th Century, raced through from the French Revolution up to the death of Pius XII in 1958. So setting the stage is a big part of the book.
Yes, that is a long 19th century, 150 years.
Right, yes, yeah. I get a lot of kidding about that, but I'm sticking to it, so.
And so you go through Vatican I as well in that
well,
chapter?
Well, briefly, yeah. I go through the sort of what was going on intellectually in Catholicism, what was going on politically. For instance, one very interesting thing is in the 19th century in Europe, Catholics were intellectually and politically marginalized. But on the eve of Vatican II, they were the dominant leaders in politics in Europe and JFK in the States.
Interesting.
So it was a Catholic moment politically.
Now, what are some of the parallels you see between Trent and Vatican II?
Well, Trent was a reform council in that it was looking to a very specific reform of church structures. That is to say, it... It wanted to get the bishops back in their dioceses. It wanted to give them an agenda once they got back there. And then only one diocese per bishop. So in the long run, Trent was successful. It took a long time to get that working. I mean, you know, some places in 40 years and some places 200 years. But eventually it was accomplished. Vatican II was quite different. Aggiornamento was the updating, kind of a soft word for reform. And what I do, I mean, sort of along that line, I say there were sort of three issues under the issues at Vatican II, and one of the issues was the relationship between what I call center and periphery. That is to say, the relationship between the Vatican offices especially and the papacy and the episcopacy, the rest of the church, So again, it's a sort of a structural issue, quite differently formulated than a Trent, but there are parallels.
Well, very interesting. Now, when is this book due out?
It's on the fall list for Harvard University Press. What happened at Vatican II? It's a little bit of a commercial here. And it should be out by certainly the latest, by the late summer.
Okay. What happened at Vatican II from Harvard University Press? Now, we thought we'd also talk about another project you have underway with St. Joseph's University Press. Now, you recently published a history of Jesuits and the arts with them, which is a very attractive book with lots of illustrations. And now that book has led to this project, which is Early Modern Catholicism and the Visual Arts. Maybe you could tell us about that.
Well, as I said, my original field was Renaissance, so I was therefore interested in art and art history, although I'm not an art historian by any count. But I did then a history of the Jesuits, the early Jesuits, the first Jesuits, and began to realize how involved they were in art. For many reasons. One being that they were priests, they had these churches, they were building new churches, and as time went on, they engaged the leading artists of the day. I mean, Bernini, Rubens would be the two most outstanding ones. But besides that, with their schools, they became specialists really in theater, which led them into music, dance, and all kinds of special effects. They were sort of the great special effects artists of the 17th and 18th century. And then, so they're in some way sort of in the vanguard there, but Catholicism itself is, it's very tactile and it's very embodied, and especially given the fact that most of the Protestant churches were leery, if not antagonistic, towards the visual arts, Catholicism just kind of went to town on it. So there's so much to be done there, and relatively little. I mean, Catholicism has now been sort of discovered by historians, so we hope to capitalize on that booming industry.
So this is going to be a series where you're looking at early modern Catholicism. What do you mean, after the Reformation?
Yes, basically. Again, what are you going to call that period? The term Counter-Reformation is kind of loaded, and even Catholic Reformation is sort of loaded, because my thesis is that Catholicism is bigger than either of those categories. It's what about Matteo Ricci in China? It's not Counter-Reformation. It's
sure.
What about Bartolomeo de las Casas in Spanish America and so forth? So early modern Catholicism, let's say 15th, 16th, 17th century.
Now, the description of this series here says that the arts sort of got support from the Council of Trent, which, as you say here, sort of affirms the efficacy of sacred images to counter Protestant disdain and even iconoclasm. So there was almost a propaganda element to it as well?
Yes. I mean, I think that if you look at that art, there's a propaganda element to it. There's an instructive element to it. But I think deep down, what's basically there, it's touching the affect and sort of... Actually, a lot of it is simply devotional. So trying to get people more in touch with themselves and with God and then with the saints and the angels and all those wonderful creatures that help us.
So you're hoping in this series to cover not just the visual arts, but also other, as you mentioned, dance. I mean, are those things you hope to incorporate as well?
Well, I mean, if we can. I mean, it's sort of difficult to incorporate dance because unless you have some sketches and things like this. But if a book comes along... that does it, we'll consider it, and if it's good, we'll publish it. So.
Right, the idea right now is that you have a couple in the works, but you're inviting proposals. So
right, but so we're advertising and inviting proposals, and we've got a couple in the works, which just began. It's less than a year old.
So. Okay.
And it takes a while for a book, you know.
So. Sure. So if people are interested, they could go to the St. Joseph's University Press website, and there's information there.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. Well, the last thing we thought we'd talk about is the upcoming congregation that is being held by the Jesuits in Rome in January. Father O'Malley is also a historian of the Jesuits, so we thought we'd use his expertise there. Now, maybe you can tell us a bit about how this process works. We have delegates that are elected from all over the world to attend this conference, congregation.
That's right. Every province of the Jesuits elects one, two, or three members, depending on the size of the province, and then the provincial goes. but the number of delegates who are elected must always exceed the number who go by holding an office. And I myself was at the congregation in 1983 that elected Father Kolvenbach, the current general, who has resigned. So the delegates gather. There'll be, I don't know, somewhere around 230, 250 of them. And they go through about 10 days of just sort of formalities, just a chance to get to know each other and know one another. Then at a certain point, the congregation itself, because the congregation is the highest authority in the Jesuits, it's higher than the general. The general simply is executor of the decisions of the congregation. The congregation decides, okay, now the process begins. And what's that mean? That means, okay, no more outside contact. We'll take 3 days, and we will murmur. That's the official word. We will murmur. So you go around from person to person, and you may ask about an individual, what the person thinks, and the person must respond honestly, what he knows directly, what he knows indirectly. But the number of candidates really gets very quickly reduced because, first of all, the person must speak at least three languages, at least English, Spanish, and Italian. The person must have had some international experience to be able to govern this big, sprawling international organization, and must also have had some kind of administrative experience and been successful at it. So the number gets reduced pretty quickly. And then you may not, matter of fact, if you are perceived as promoting someone, that's reason for being expelled from the congregation. I mean, it's
interesting.
It's really designed to eliminate politicking, and I have to say, from my own experience, it does. When I went, I thought this is the dumbest thing I ever heard. 3 days of going around kind of murmuring, but it worked. The evening before we went for the election, and we're locked in a room until we elect, so there's no fooling around. I mean, you don't get out until you elect, so it's a real conclave. I said, it's going to be Kolvenbach, it will be on the first ballot, and it will be overwhelming. And I was absolutely right.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Now, in this case, obviously Father Kolvenbach is still living, but in the past, the congregations were generally held when a general had passed away.
Right. I mean, there have been a few exceptions up until in the middle of the 20th century, when a general, long general aid or some kind of a crisis, there have been a few. Congregations are for electing a general and for setting policy. And in general, the policy is set at when a new general is elected. So the first general to resign was Father Arupe in 1983 because he'd had a stroke. And Father Kolvenbach, I mean, he's been a fine general, but he's been general now for, 23 years or something like that. So I think he feels it's time to step down. And he's still vigorous, so that's the time to do it.
So there are procedures in place in the rules of the order which allow for this?
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, what's very interesting is from St. Ignatius himself are very clear provisions in the congregation what to do if a general becomes incapacitated physically or incapacitated mentally or creates a big scandal. I mean, how to deal with that? It's very clearly laid down. It's very provident, I'd say, unlike the church itself, which, I mean, as we know, there's no provision what to do if a pope falls into a coma and stays in a coma for 2 years.
Interesting.
Or 3 years.
Yeah, so in some ways, what goes on with the Jesuits could serve as a model for perhaps if the church was to consider a different procedure for the papacy.
Right, or at least some procedure.
Right.
Because I think, you know, in the time in which we live, when people can sort of linger on for a long, long time.
Sure. Yep. It's a very different time than it was 500 years ago. So.
Right.
Well, Father O'Malley, we know you're busy, and we thank you so much for coming to stop by.
Thank you, Tim.
Okay, take care now. Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of the American Magazine Podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast by clicking on the podcast link on our homepage or going to americamagazine.podbean.com, where you can subscribe via iTunes. We'd like to thank Bill McGarvey, who provided music for this week's show. This is Tim Reedy, for America Magazine.